all the talk, all the time. This is TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio. Look while you listen live. Visit WildAboutPets.net for more about the show on TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to the show and my discussion with Dr. Stanley Koren, author of The Intelligence of Dogs. Our phone lines are open if you'd like to call in. The number is 888-463-6748, and it's July 17th. We are talking about that selecting a breed for your household is very, very important, what kind of breed it is, and knowing some of the different types of intelligence that certain breeds do very well at is a part of this. So let's talk a little bit more, Dr. Koren, about some of the pros and cons of the really, really intelligent dogs. Because, you know, everybody says, oh, of course I want a really intelligent dog, but this may not be the wisest thing. Can you tell us why?
Well, for example, I always warn people, you know, the top seven breeds of dogs are the Border Collie, the Poodle, the German Shepherd, the Golden Retriever, the Doberman Pinscher, the Little Shetland Sheepdog, and the Labrador Retriever. So those are your top seven breeds of dogs. And, you know, a lot of people have this notion, you know, well, I want, you know, the smartest dog, right? So they go ahead and they get a Border Collie, and very often that is an absolute mistake because, you know, Border Collies are very active dogs, and they have to be worked. And if they're not worked every day, then, in fact, they become neurotic, and they're smart enough to make you neurotic, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it really depends on your lifestyle. For example, you know, we had a woman who had a Border Collie, and she worked all during the day. And, of course, the Border Collie had nothing to do, so he started stripping the wallpaper off of the walls.
Oh, no.
You know, so you really have to, you have to make the decision on the basis of your lifestyle. Suppose you're out of the house because you worked, let's say, 8-10 hours a day. Well, you know, a Doberman Pinscher might be, a wonderful dog to have. You know, he's number five in the list and that sort of thing. But when you go away, you know, he's going to be very bored. And so what he's going to do is he's going to destroy your sofa and he's going to, you know, wipe out your Ming vase collection. Whereas, suppose you got a bulldog. You know, bulldogs are, you know, the English bulldog is third from the bottom. And he's a very sweet dog, and but it's going to take him 8 hours to figure out that you were gone. And so when you get home, here's this very sweet dog who says, I know you, and that sort of thing. You know, and in fact, your furniture is still intact, and your pottery is still on the shelf. And there are other ways in which, you know, people keep asking me, you know, right now my youngest dog is a beagle. And people say, well, you got a beagle? You know, don't you believe your own research? Aren't beagles, you know, the seventh dog from the bottom? Well, yeah, I mean, if I'm looking for a working and obedience dog, I'm certainly not going to get a beagle. But I had other reasons why I had a beagle. I have 9 grandchildren. And so I needed a dog who was extremely sociable and was quite sturdy and unbreakable. And in fact, whose, you know, mind was not so good so that, you know, he doesn't remember that that was the particular grandkid who twisted his ear an hour ago.
Right.
So, you know, you pick the animals on the basis of your needs and your lifestyles. Intelligence is just one of the factors, and it's an important one, especially if you're going to work your dog. So, for example, I normally put my dogs compete in obedience competitions, and they usually get their first degree when they're about 18 months of age. Well, you know, my beagle took 4.5 years to get its first degree. So, I mean, you know, it's obviously not the case that if you're looking for a working dog, that you should pick dogs from the bottom. But also, one of the reasons why we have this list is it's very important that people understand what they're getting into. It's not that the dogs can't do the work.
Right.
It's just that it's much more effort. So, you know, you go to a dog obedience class, and, you know, the boxer lady is sort of looking at her dog because it takes him the first 8 weeks just to learn his name. Mm-hmm. And the poodle lady, you know, after the second lesson is, you know, tutoring the other dogs.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always the problem that the boxer lady is going to say, I've got the most stupid dog in the world. And if she understands in advance that, no, this is a sort of a low, middle-of-the-pack dog, and it just takes more work, then, in fact, she knows what she's in for. And that's part of the importance of understanding just where your dog fits in the game.
And to really know what you mean by that in your book, after you have the rankings of the dogs, you also this goes along with your test, the canine IQ test in scoring, you explain what the rankings mean, you know, practically. Well, what will this probably look like if you're trying to train the dog, or what will this mean to you? And I again will reiterate what you've said, that this ranking is not like, well, these dogs are the best dogs and the low dogs are bad dogs. That's not the case at all. This is a matter of seems like in their amount of intelligence for learning, you know, and responding to commands, you know, either in obedience or just by the owners, how do they do? You know, are they quick learners? You know, can they associate things easily, or are they a little slower? So I like that you mentioned that, and I wanted to stress that also.
Well, you have to remember that all dogs have an instinctive intelligence.
Yes.
You know, regardless of what they're working in, obedience intelligence is. So, you know, the caboose, sort of the bottom of the ranking, is the Afghan hound. And, you know, so people, you know, sometimes say to me, well, you know, that means nobody should go out and get an Afghan hound. Well, you know, the Afghan hound is very low in terms of its working and obedience intelligence, but it's got an incredible instinctive intelligence. It's a sight hound. It's designed. It was designed to sort of chase down and, you know, to pursue and chase antelope and gazelle. And if you've ever watched one of these dogs, if your listeners ever get a chance to go to a lure coursing trial, you know, you'll very often see Afghan hounds running in those. And if you see them, they seem to defy gravity. I mean, they are gorgeous when they run. The other thing is that, you know, the Afghan hound may be at the bottom of the group, but in fact, it's beautiful. I mean, it's an absolutely gorgeous dog. And every year, I notice that People magazine puts out an issue, which is on the 50 most beautiful people in the world, and they never put out an issue on the 50 most intelligent people in the world. So, you know, what is it that people, you know, are prizing? I mean, you know, where are the people who are going ooh and ah at Paris Hilton or Pamela Anderson saying that they are geniuses, or are they making some other judgment?
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the aspect of intelligent dogs and in training them, because this is so key to me. I've seen people trying to train, you know, some of the more intelligent dogs, and they get frustrated and they think, see, this dog just can't be trained. But actually, and they think my dog is supposed to be the smart dog, but it's not. And I think what's going on, and you speak about this, and there's a story I'll have you tell in a moment about a golden retriever by the name of Shadow, where actually the dog is smarter than you even know. And it's what the dog owner, in the way that they're training, is where the mistake lies, not in the dog. Can you tell us about Shadow?
Well, Shadow was a very bright golden retriever and doing quite well in an obedience course. And one day the family, you know, couldn't, the mother in the family who was doing the training for the dog couldn't be there. So she sent her teenage son to take Shadow through the class. So we were doing an exercise in which people control their dogs from a distance, you know, so you indicate to your dog to sit from, you know, 6 feet away or that kind of thing. And And the boy was getting very frustrated because, you know, he I don't think he really wanted to be there. But anyway, Shadow was standing, and he finally says, "Come on, Shadow, sit down." And the next thing you knew, Shadow engaged in the most bizarre kind of behavior. It's sort of at a half crouch. He started to sort of drag himself toward the boy, and the boy just got very frustrated. "This is the most stupid dog in the world." And if you stop and you think about it, in fact, Shadow was being incredibly brilliant, okay? Because he had three commands. He had it and down, and so he's trying to do all of them at the same time.
Yes.
so you really do have to be very careful about this. And one of the other things which you have to understand is a real pattern of behavior which you get between the top dogs and the bottom dogs, okay? The top dogs, the ones who are the best in terms of working and obedience intelligence, also have the highest variability in their behavior. They will keep trying new things to see whether they work, whether they're better solutions, and that sort of thing. So, you know, you'll think you'll have this dog perfectly trained, and you'll give him a command, and then he does something which you've never seen before. And that's simply because, you know, the brightest dogs are always trying new things,
mm-hmm.
see what works. The dogs which are in the bottom of the group will very often, you know, glom on a particular behavior when you command them. And even if that behavior is wrong, they'll repeat it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, you know, you have to know what your dogs are like, because you have to know how you're going to deal with the problems. And if you understand what your dog is doing and what he's apt to do, then, in fact, the solutions become a lot simpler. So for dogs which are down in the bottom of the list, very often engaging in what we call play training, where basically what you're doing is you're turning all of the exercises into a sort of a game, works a lot better, because that helps to stimulate the dog to try new things and to eventually blunder onto the one that works.
Can you give an example?
Well, a simple example is if I'm trying to train my beagle do a particular response. So, for example, in some of the advanced rally things, you know, the dogs have to go around and around the owner in different directions and that sort of thing. Well, you know, he had learned how to go to heel back into the position sitting by my left foot, and he learned it very well, but he learned the one way. So in order to get him out of that, we turned everything into a game. So I, you know, had a tennis ball on a string, and I would bounce it in front of him, and then I'd bounce him around in the direction that I wanted. Well, by this time, his tail was up, and he was wagging and this sort of thing, and he was trying new things, not because, you know, he was working on the obedience task, but simply because it was now a game, so it wasn't this thing which he had learned before. Now, if you do that with a border collie, for example, or with some, you know, poodles or goldens or that sort of thing, they get overexcited.
Mm.
And so their behavior becomes so variable that, in fact, they're very, very difficult to train. So for a dog like that, part of your game is you have to calm them down. So that's the way that your strategies have to sort of vary depending upon the dog breed that you're working with.
And in your book, you also list for both the very smart dogs and the not so smart dogs what some of those very important things to do in the strategies. And I love that because you're very, very specific. For example, for the not so smart dogs, you say, and you have a little paragraph, you know, with each one of these, like train young, be consistent, be explicit, begin quietly, short sessions. And then, like, for the smart dogs, you know, you say that smart dogs actually need those basics training more than the less, you know, smart dogs. Never let the dog get away with anything without having to work for it, and why. And that's fascinating. And how to control your emotions. And I love that you're very specific about these strategies, because I know we're throwing out a lot of, you know, great big ideas, but it's like, well, how do you do this specifics. In your book, The Intelligence of Dogs, you talk about those very specifics. We only have a few moments left, Dr. Korn, but you did mention, you know, your latest book, The Modern Dog, and so I have a photo, I have the photo art, the cover art, which is wonderful. Can you tell us very briefly, in like the 2 minutes we have, what is The Modern Dog about?
Well, The Modern Dog is really how dogs fit into our modern society. It's really about the human-animal bond. So it's a bit about the dog behaviors and how we interpret those and how the behaviors came about. And also really where dogs fit. I mean, you know, dogs are not wolves. They're not wild animals. They're not tamed wild animals. They've been very specifically developed to fit into our human society and to understand our human language. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, this is what dogs really are, and this is how they fit. And in some respects, this is how they make our lives better.
And when did you write this book?
This book just came out at the end of last year, beginning of this year. It's, you know, it was written like all my books over a period of about 9 months.
Oh, okay. And, you know, the human-animal bond is being spoken about in so many different ways, and we're finding out so much, you know, even with the research of what this bond really is. And, in fact, the last show I did had to do a little bit about with that also in some of the service and rescue dogs. So it's very timely. And let's see, I did have a picture of the Cavalier King Charles dogs, because I know you had so you don't have a King Charles anymore?
No, Bam Bam, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, so this is past, because I have on this caption that you own one, because I did not know about that.
I will tell you very, very quickly on this. He came from a household from a dog breeder, so he always had competition for toys and things. And when he came to my house, he didn't have any competition for toys, and he loved plush toys. So he would gather them around and put them in the footwell of my desk. And if my grandkids were here, he'd gather up their plush toys. And he actually died sleeping on his pile of plush toys. And I always thought to myself, that was God saying, yeah, that's a nice dog, and you get a pleasant way to go.
Oh, that's a lovely story, Dr. Korn. My guest today has been Stanley Korn, author of The Intelligence of Dogs. The link to his website, stanleykorn.com, and how to order this book and others is at the bottom of the page of my photos on my website, wildaboutpets.net. And you can also find that link on the episode page on talkzone.com. Thank you so much for being with me today, Dr. Korn.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, I'll be talking to the author Ruth Padel about her 2-year adventure traveling the world in the quest for the last wild tigers. Thank you for listening.